Hello, and welcome to Building Sustainability Podcast. I'm your host, Geoffrey Hart, aka Geoffrey the Natural Builder. Building Sustainability consists of conversations with designers, builders, makers, dreamers, and doers, exploring the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things. Hello, and welcome to the podcast. This is episode 42. This episode, we are talking to Ben Kerslake of Carrington Lime about treating damp with lime plaster, among other lime geekery. Before I introduce Ben, there's a little bit of great podcast news. Building Sustainability Podcast is a finalist in the ASBP 2021 Awards, which are Ideas for a Better Built Environment. So the ASBP is the Alliance for Sustainable Building Products. Yeah, I'm so honoured to be in the final with five other great projects. I'm feeling a little bit of imposter syndrome, if I'm honest. Yeah, not really sure what I'm doing there. But yeah, as I say, totally honoured that you know, this hard work has been sort of recognised and people think it's a good thing. So as part of the ASBP's Healthy Building Conference, I will be presenting Building Sustainability along with the other finalists. We get a 10-minute slot where you can see a video that I produced. I do a talk and then there's some questions. And then at the end of the presentations, there is a people's vote, which will be announced actually just a few minutes afterwards. So the people's vote will be announced and the judge's decision as well. So that's pretty exciting. So if you'd like to attend this event, it's online, obviously. There is the Healthy Buildings Conference is on the 24th of February and the awards ceremony is on the 25th. So that's Thursday, the 25th of February, 2021. It's free if you want to come along. You'll see myself and five other excellent projects present a little bit about what they're doing. And there is a link to register in the show notes. Obviously, if you fancy voting for Building Sustainability, I definitely won't dissuade you, but you should definitely vote for who you think is the best. Okay, so Ben Kerslake from Carrington Lime. This is from the About section on Carrington Lime's website. The aim of Carrington Lime is to promote the use of traditional building methods and materials in a modern way. Love it. That's what I'm all about too. So this conversation gets pretty nerdy. I know that lime as a building material can be quite a confusing topic. It's one of those topics that I think you learn a little bit more every time you read or hear about it. And then that gives you more questions and then you realise that it's actually quite a big and complex thing. So often in this conversation, we'll go into different types of lime and their properties. And Ben does a really great job of describing the different types in respect to their compressive strength. And I just wanted to add to that, that tied to the compressive strength of different limes is their vapour permeability. And generally speaking, softer limes are more vapour permeable and harder limes are less vapour permeable. And I guess I also wanted to just clarify, Ben uses the term breathability to describe vapour permeability. And breathability is kind of the industry term for vapour permeability, but it's a slightly confusing one and slightly misleading. So if you don't know what breathability means, then I think you'd probably assume it's something to do with air movement. And actually, it's about moisture movement. So, I mean, as I'm sure we're all aware at the moment, having to wear face masks when we go shopping, when we're breathing out, you're exhaling a lot of moisture. And so your mask gets hot and wet and your glasses are fogging up. So that's the moisture that's being breathed out. And that's what we mean by breathability. So I'll chuck some links to lime theory and vapor permeability in the show notes if you want to learn some more. Okay, on with the episode. And I'm back at the end to tell you how you can get 60 whole pounds for free for making the world a better place. And this isn't some sort of scam. It's actually just a really nice thing to do. So enjoy the episode and I'll see you at the end.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, I left school and went straight into building with a friend, and roofing, natural slate roofing. And then I moved to Southwest Wales. So I think that was 99. Mm-hmm. So just turning 20, I think. And ended up, I was working with a company that did barn renovations, and in a very sort of modern way.
So using what sort of materials?
So it would generally go in and sort of batten up the internal walls of these beautiful stone barns, and layer them up with plastic and DPC, maybe put a bit of insulation in or Sellotex, and then plasterboard them and skim them, and instantly, and we were doing that with the floors and the walls, and instantly, even putting the plastic up and putting the timber over it, you could see the condensation buildup was instantly huge with all of us working in there. Mm-hmm. And we were trying to sort out damp problems a lot of the time because there was cement pointing and just trapping moisture, and it just looks really sort of strange, really wrong. And then we'd put a breathable membrane in the roof and the ceiling. So I remember one day saying, well, if we're putting a breathable membrane on the roof, why don't we put it on the walls? And it was just like, oh, stop asking stupid questions, Ben. It was just like, what are you talking about? I think that might have just got me started, really. And then finding that kind of a few years later, once we finally got the internet, then that was it. I was able to sort of explore it a bit more. Mm. And looking at the different mixes that were used in Wales, Southwest Wales then, and the cement we were putting in, and how very different it was, and the problems it caused.
So you were in Southwest Wales doing barn renovations, and then how did you end up? Where are you now? Gloucester way?
Yeah, Chapman? It's Forest of Dean.
Nice.
So the chap that I was working with then, his son was a good friend of mine, and we started to talk about sort of the lime and stuff, and the boss had given us some jobs to do, just me and the boss's son Toby, to just do some lime jobs, and it started from there, really.
Right.
And then I'd worked with a few companies that were doing lime in Wales, and I worked for Griff Rees-Jones doing a project down there. The Pembrokeshire Farm series that was on TV.
I saw his what do you call it? The feedback on your website that came from Griff Rees-Jones.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I was like, is that, could that be the same? So yes,
yes,
it is.
Yes, that was good actually. He there was a farmhouse, a mill, a beautiful old mill, and a cottage, and a load of barns that we worked on over a good few years. And he just gave us free rein, really. The nice. Site manager, she was great. We were able to put our ideas in, and so it was a really nice project to work on, and time was no issue.
Oh, a dream.
And money wasn't so much of an issue either. And they were making a TV program about it as well. So, and then, well, they kind of, the cameraman kind of pinched my labourer and gave him this sort of 10 grand camera to keep to film when he wasn't there. So I kind of lost a labourer who became a cameraman. And then, yeah, so he was constantly being interviewed as well, because he was the only one that could, that was any good on telly. The rest right. of us, whenever there's a camera pointed at us, we just went to pieces. So none of us, the only time I got onto the TV was walking past with a wheelbarrow and then putting a timber beam in, because everything I said was just, I just went to pieces because the camera.
I had the exact same thing. I remember being in Utah and they filmed like maybe four or five people who were on the building site, and then used everyone else except me. It's like, oh, thank goodness for that. Nice. Okay, where were we? So you sort of starting your journey into Lime and better building.
Yeah, so we working with Griffiths Jones, that was really good. And then after that project started to come to a close, and there was I ended up with the opportunity to come up towards Gloucester to work. I worked with another company that we were just spraying lime renders, but it was just lime putty, and the only aggregate was stone dust.
Okay,
which was really good, and that worked really well in most situations. But whenever there was any sort of slight damp in the walls, or it didn't get a chance to dry out, because the putty needs to dry to carbonate. So if there's any water or excess water still in the render and in the putty, then it just doesn't have a chance to carbonate. So then you end up getting some bad weather, or it goes through a winter and you get failures. So I was working there for quite a few years, but throughout the different places I'd been working, I'd been seeing failures through damp in all sorts of situations, through the wrong materials, whether that be cement and different types of lime, and when lime does fail. So I was in a really fortunate position, even though it felt like a nightmare to deal with all these failures all the time, to kind of get a good understanding of how materials were working and how damp was moving through walls and the rest of it, really. So mm-hmm. after working there, we started Carrington Lime, Kate and I, my wife, and mainly it was fixing damp problems.
Okay.
So then we got to see a really good range of damp in different buildings, and that all the other damp proofing techniques that had been happening since, well, some really good ones in the 70s, and just crazy stuff that we saw not working.
Yeah.
And how we could work that out.
Nice.
And so, some of the crazy things, like weaving copper cables through walls, like drilling electrolysis.
Okay.
So I think it still may go on, but it was definitely big in the 70s, where I've seen it a lot, where these copper cables are woven through the base of a wall at every 6 to 8 inches. So drilling holes through this solid wall, just destroying the wall to weave this copper cable through to kind of plug it into the ground.
Okay.
Or to try and stop damp, which obviously didn't work. Even then to the modern side, where they're doing it silicone injection, that just is, I mean, it's the same thing, where they're drilling holes every 6 to 8 inches, squeezing some silicone in and expecting it to completely make a barrier so that no water or damp can wick up through the material, which again is, we see it rarely, well, if ever working. So
yes, I've seen certainly more problems than solutions with that stuff.
Yes.
So what is, do you have like a typical type of building that you're working on in that area, like an age or
we've got everything from the sort of more modern solid walls to even cavity walls from 1920s, 1930s that still use lime.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in Cheltenham, but what we've found in Cheltenham, there's the mixes are very sandy and silty. So they don't even have much clay and very little lime. So they really suffer from the damp because the silt just seems to hold on to that moisture.
Mm.
And whereas clay can get damp but still retain some strength, the silt, so you end up, you can grab a brick and just kind of
right.
move it from side to side. And so when you've got cement renders on the outside and plastic paints that just hold that moisture in even more, and then whatever on the inside. So yeah, we see a lot of problems in Cheltenham with those houses moving a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
And needing some to sort of get the bricks back into some sort of compression before we even start rendering and plastering. To the houses in the Forest of Dean, which are beautifully cut sandstone that's really quite hard, but the mortar has to work extremely hard because of those bricks. Those stones are quite, sandstone is quite impervious. So that you need a softer mortar and plaster and render to allow moisture to move through that rather than the stone.
Yeah.
So yeah, a bit of everything sort of with the, and definitely we have a lot of these kind of hidden timber frames that the old ship timbers were used in that you don't see from the outside. It just looks like an old brick building, but inside they've got all sorts of amazing timber work, like from cruck frames inside to all sorts, where they just had, I suppose they weren't allowed to use the timber from the forest, and it was all secondhand ship timbers that were used. So whatever the size and shape of the timber was kind of used wherever it was needed. So we've got some really interesting architecture, and so we see a lot. Which is nice. It's no sort of one type of building or one issue. So that's why we're very open to the materials that we use, that we're not just constantly using, right, we have to use a putty or mm-hmm. a hotline for everything, because that's not going to work.
Yeah.
We need to look at it holistically and maybe slow down the rates of absorption by using a hydraulic lime, and then we can tweak the strength of that with the mix and by adding clay and looking at what's already there, because a lot of the mortar that we've got and the plasters and renders are sort of clay based with a little bit of lime in.
Yeah.
And very little sand usually.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah. It's, I mean, you fairly, when you break down some of the original 200 year old, 150 plus, it's very rarely got much sand in. It might have some bigger stone and aggregate and stone dust, but usually it's very clayey with sort of stone waste and maybe some clinker and
ash. What is clinker?
So the solid pieces that when you've had a furnace or you can burn in charcoal or coal, I think, so they're very sort of solid bits of burnt charcoal or maybe coal.
Okay.
Which we find still in the mixes with solid bits of lime, unburnt lime, mm-hmm. That was mixed as a hot lime for the mortar. And whether they used the clinker as a pozzolan to set the for the hot lime to become hydraulic, because when you look at the historical mixes, and we think that just putty is a historical mix, but a lot of the time, well, that putty was made with in a kiln with the charcoal, which worked as a pozzolan. So these hot limes are always, and these limes are always, had a hydraulic element to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other things they were adding. So very, very clay mixes, or very, if they're a bit cleaner with less clay in, they add a lot of stone dust in. So really light coloured with very little sand.
Love the sort of regional variations. Like, yeah, that's going to be quite a specific area where you're finding those sort of lime with the clinker and it makes very localized knowledge. I like that.
Yeah, definitely. It's and even from the difference from sort of the time scales and from Cheltenham, where it's just really sandy, silty stuff they had around with, and they put a very little lime in. I think at the time when they were building the majority of Cheltenham, it was, they were firing it up. It was as quick as possible, just get them built. And the base coats are all the same material.
Are they really?
So, I mean, if they get damp, they're, and then they're usually gypsum plastered over. So, all the ground store is, it's generally gone, but higher up above 1.2 meters where they usually sort of try and tank it, it's a lot of the time it's still intact. So,
I like that element of, kind of, you know, sort of historian almost, you know, looking at, or archaeologist maybe, like looking at the little details and sort of figuring out how things were, you know, back in the day.
Yeah, that really makes me realise how sort of short-sighted the kind of industry can be, even the sort of the lime industry, that it's that we think there's just this one size fits all, even with the lime. So it's like they've been talking recently about it's just putty, you can only use putty. But we've got this whole range of materials we can use, from a putty that might be a compressive strength of maybe one, and then a NHLs that have the compressive strength of two to a five, and then we've got the natural cement, like Prompt, that's probably a 12. And then some of the older cements that are pre-1950 and before that are probably maybe a 25 or something, that actually do still work quite well on some of these buildings because they are breathing and fairly well until they get painted with plastic paints, all the way up to maybe like a compressive strength rating of 50 for a modern Portland cement. And we've got this whole range, this amazing range. And then we've got clay, which I've been listening to your podcast and getting quite excited about again, because that was what my first sort of love of building was, sort of the natural building and using clays and straw bales and things, which I don't get to do so much or much at all now.
Yeah, because you built your own straw bale house, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, it was, that was when I was down in Southwest Wales, and I'd seen a few. I don't know what got me started. Maybe it was a few grand designs. I think I saw Ben Law build his round wood, and I was just, I have to do that.
I became a natural builder.
I just thought it was just so amazing, and what it's all about. I think, because in 1995 I went to India for a few months, and I saw sort of the kind of natural materials being used and lived in, and I think that probably affected me quite a lot. And I ended up moving into a housing co-op down there, which is this beautiful old mansion farmhouse, three stories, and we tried to sort of live much more sustainably, which we found out was really hard if you're not in a village doing it, and have the support of all the different trades. And but that was really good. So I had to build a straw bale house. So dug out the foundation, hired a mini digger, dug out the foundations, used that as my render and plaster. And just, I didn't sieve it at all. I just kind of whacked it into I had a bath with a fire, because it was, I think we ended up plastering in the winter. So I had a bath with a fire, a steel bath with a fire underneath it to warm the plaster. Nice. So we had this steaming clay.
Hot clay
plaster.
Mixes. That's not a thing.
Lovely.
That's not a thing we do, is it? That's.
Yeah. So yeah, it was, you've got to experiment. But so yeah, just whacking that on the walls, and then. And because I'd never done it before, it was just why the books I'd read and the internet. So when I had some gaps, because I managed to get some sash windows, ridiculously cheap. I think I got about six floor to ceiling sash windows for for 150 quid from the reclaim yard.
Nice.
So they just went in floor to ceiling, from, well, roof plate to floor plate. They went in. And so any gaps, we had a hazel coppice there. So we just sort of tacked the hazel in to the roof plate and the wall plate and just tacked side bars in, mm-hmm. and plastered all that with the clay and straw mixes. And so, yeah, that's what I loved. And yeah, that was great fun. And an earth floor. But I didn't realize after listening to your podcast with the earth floor lady about using the linseed oil. I wish I'd known about that then, because I just had a finished earth floor. And obviously it was dusty, but yeah, we put a rug down, and it was, it was lovely. We had a Rayburn business at the housing co-op.
Yeah.
So I managed to get a free Rayburn, and my mate plumbed it in for nothing. And it just stayed so warm, and it was like, I've lived in so many, because I was renting throughout that time. I'm renting these houses that just worked terribly, that I couldn't afford to heat. And we got in this straw bale house that I'd made for kind of 1500 quid. And it was amazing. It was just warm. It was comfortable. It was beautiful. It was, it definitely started the, I think that's what started me off.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah. Nice. I wanted to go back to damp proofing, partly because on your website it says don't get you started about damp proofing. And that's exactly what I want to do.
Okay, excellent. Yeah.
What do you do when you go into a building that's got damp? What are you looking for?
So usually we go in and generally it's had modern materials put on, mm-hmm. and that's what's failing, because the amount of times where the client's really worried because the paint won't stay on the walls, it's bubbling off, the plaster's breaking down, the salts from the plaster are just coming out and fluorescing. All that, so you've got centimetre thick salts on the walls coming out in patches everywhere, and they think they've got a horrific damp problem. Mm-hmm. And even sometimes sort of the black moulds on the surface, which some of those black molds contribute to sick building syndrome and are horrific for your health. And we go in and instantly I'll know whether there's actual damp in the wall or whether it's just the materials, just gypsum holding, mm-hmm. holding condensation. And generally most of the time it's probably 80, 90% of the time it's the walls are dry. It's just gypsum. The gypsum on the surface of some lime or some cement base coat that's just holding moisture. Mm-hmm. And once the gypsum gets some excess moisture in it, it might even be there's been a few patch repairs made with gypsum and it's not actually had the chance to dry out before it's attracting condensation, because as soon as you've got a cold area on your wall, it only needs to be a few degrees colder, or maybe have a bit of damp in it, which makes it a few degrees colder. And the warm, moist air from a normal environment from the room just condensates on it, and it just takes mm-hmm. it on board. And then when it dries out, and because gypsum seems to be so full of salts or minerals, that the condensation will happen. It will bring salts to the surface. And even if you don't see them, they come to the surface through the evaporation and they instantly attract condensation again. It's the same as if you have a salt, an open salt bowl in your kitchen, it instantly just gets wet because it's exactly the same thing in the walls. And even if you don't see the salt fluorescing on the surface, if you scratch it, you can hear that kind of a different sound. It's like a crystalline sound. So it's got a ring to it, or it just sounds different to the rest of the plaster.
Mm-hmm.
And usually just taking that off, even if it's only a few mil, it's bone dry underneath. And it's just replacing that with a breathable plaster that isn't full of salts or minerals, then it just works perfect. It's an instant fix. So
nice.
If you have a really bad damp problem where there's a lot of moisture coming up into the wall and the wall is soaked, you'll really know about it because it will be covered in sort of the black molds, and it's really evident. So these small little strange patches are generally just gypsum plaster not working very well. It's just a really bad material, especially on a solid wall.
Yeah. I think probably quite a lot of people might not have realised that, would have assumed that if it's a damp problem, it's from outside. You know, that's where the wet is. That's where, it's raining. Certainly in this country, it's raining a lot. So it might be quite surprising for some people to hear that actually the damp problem is caused by their own just living, breathing, showering, cooking.
So maybe less than 95% of issues are from internal damp or from ground levels. You do get an issue with if people's guttering's not working, but that's not really down to outside damp. The only sort of real outside damp issues is when you've got an exposed building, probably brick, a very soft brick, that you've had maybe a week's worth of sideways rain in a certain position, sort of maybe at the end of the estuary here. There's been a few houses I've worked on where the wind just comes straight up, and when it rains, it's raining sideways straight into the facade of the house, and the bricks get overwhelmed, and there's a few damp spots that come through. But if it can dry out again, then that's fine. But if it's got gypsum inside, it's never going to get the chance to dry out. So it just holds onto moisture like nothing I've ever seen. So yeah, generally it's internal issues, because you get a lot of damp proofing, which when you buy a house and get a mortgage, sometimes you're forced, just because the mortgage advisor chap that comes out to check the house, who knows nothing about building, architecture or damp, has a little moisture meter that's designed to be used on wood, sticks it into the wall once and says, oh yeah, it's a couple of percent higher, so you've got damp. You need to spend thousands on this house, taking the plaster off to 1.2 meters up the wall.
Oh, okay, height, yeah.
Because damp's rising damp, apparently. And
come back to that.
Yeah, and you need to silicone injection. You need to tank it with a swimming pool material to hold the moisture out. And then you got to plaster it with gypsum. So instantly you haven't dealt with the real issue, which is probably, if it's damp down below, ground levels are probably too high, or cement rendered all the way to the ground, so it's pulling moisture up in a capillary action, or there's a crack in the cement render, so it's again pulling moisture in. So when you've got a crack in the cement render that's pretty impervious to moisture, it creates this capillary action where it actually pulls moisture in. And when you've got such soft materials, usually in this area very soft brick, they just absorb this moisture and it can't escape. So then you've got your damp problem. So they haven't dealt with these issues. They've just basically put tank in on the inside. So that cement on the outside, plastic paint, tank in on the inside, gypsum on the surface, it basically fills up. And that wall gets so wet then that it's so cold that you get this condensation that goes onto the gypsum plaster that just makes it fail instantly if it ever gets a chance to dry in the first place. And you've just got an even worse problem that you spent thousands on. and it's, but you've had to do it to buy this house. So we've got some really great people that are trying to change this at the minute, like Peter Ward, for one, that's been doing some amazing work trying to get it sorted. But it seems like it's kind of just such a racket that it's just a nightmare. But
is there I don't have much experience with the sort of modern conventional building world. Is there a scenario when tanking like actually works?
When you say works, I mean, it does stop, it does hold moisture brilliantly. Yeah. So for swimming pools, it's probably fantastic. But I've seen places that I go to some of these jobs and there's a line of damp 1.2 meters across the whole room. Because they haven't used gypsum, at least. It's just cement render painted. And people go, well, I don't know why I've got this lamp, this wet stripe. And it's just, it's got so wet, it's risen up.
It's filled up to that point.
Basically, yeah. And I've seen it where they've gone all the way up to the first floor. And then it's driven it so far up the wall that it's rotting the first floor joists in the wall because these old buildings don't have joist hangers. Mm-hmm. It's going to rot that timber. So you need to, even when you've got a problem property, like a basement we work on, and we still use lime on the basement because we can't allow that that moisture to build up enough to rot the timbers. So we need to allow it to come out. And if the whole wall's allowing moisture to come in, then it hasn't got a chance to build up anywhere. So it's just regulating it. And that's when we'll look at maybe slowing it with an NHL base coat and then a nice thick putty top coat. So it's still, the base coat's slowing that vapor. It's not, solid water can't come through the NHL, but vapor can. So it gets a chance to constantly dry, but not get overwhelmed. And then you've still got the putty top coat to absorb any condensation and then release it and be working together as a really nice system. I've seen some places where the ground level is like a foot higher outside than inside, and it's solid, it's clay, it's holding moisture, they've tarmacked on top of it, so it just holds it all year round, and it's feeding moisture into this wall, and then there's some kind of tanking on the inside, and it's driven it up. So the timbers are so wet that the plasterboard is falling down from the ceiling because it's absolutely saturated. Yeah. And the gypsum never dries. Once it's wet, it's a downward spiral. So yeah, it's generally there's some really simple things to deal with damp in solid walls, and they never involve tanking gypsum or any of the modern materials. You have to let it breathe.
I went to see a friend of mine's. It's an old stone cottage around these parts, and they'd had three or four people to come out, damp specialists to come out, and they all said, you need to tank it, and that was their first response. And then I took a little wander around, and first of all, they're on the side of a slope, and so all the water's running down the hill, and then the ground level was probably about sort of meter and a half above the bottom of the door. So all that moisture is coming straight into the wall. And then they were putting in a new bathroom and they had half their roof off. So water was coming in. And those damp specialists never said, well, I'd start by closing up that big hole in your roof.
Yes. Yeah. It's just,
it's madness.
It's just that kind of, it's this, the same old thing, right? This is what you've got to do. This is what you could do without ever looking at what you've got. So even like you say, the massive hole in the roof, the big crack in the render, the cement render all the way down to the ground, different higher ground levels. And what material it's built out of, because these old buildings, I mean, there's the constant people say, oh, well, I've got an old building, so I don't expect it to be dry. It's going to be wet. And it's like, no, actually, the solid walls are better than a cavity. A cavity is just a really bad way to build. You're designing that. So like we were talking about all this moisture created inside the building that has to escape. With an old building, you don't need to be constantly ventilating that hot air that you spent a fortune trying to heat. The building breathes for you. It absorbs that excess moisture, and it either evaporates to the outside of the building or back inside when relative humidities come down. So you're buffering the internal environment with your walls like a Gore-Tex jacket. So we really need to think of it, these buildings, old buildings, working like a Gore-Tex jacket and not a plastic anorak.
Yes.
You're not going to want to walk up a hill with a plastic anorak on, but we're still trying to tank and render our old buildings with these impervious materials.
Mm.
But we really need to look at what's going on and what they're built with, rather than.
I like that. It's going in there, you know, with open eyes and actually sort of assessing the place rather than going in there with a predetermined idea of obviously what you need.
Exactly. Yeah, and it usually it's pretty simple. I mean, it's not that there's just some few simple things that whether yeah, have you got a hole in your roof?
That's probably is letting water in.
Is the ground level high? And these renders. I mean, the most important part for a house to breathe is that is the external facade. So mm-hmm. moisture needs to be able to escape there first. But what we seem to do, we use cement renders on the outside, and then something softer like a gypsum or plasterboard or whatever on the inside, so that the path of least resistance is always back into the building.
Yeah.
Where it should be the other way around. But
yes.
Yeah, we've got this funny mentality that we're so fearful of water getting in from outside. It's just like, seal it up. and it's just the opposite.
Yes, I think that's hard for people to grasp. Yeah, from sort of homeowner level to, you know, experienced builder levels. And I think certainly conventional builders, like, I don't think it's necessarily like their fault that they don't know these things. It's just that maybe you can become a builder without ever being taught about how moisture moves in a building. And
exactly, yeah. And it's the most money anyone will ever pay if they buy a home. And but it's just unregulated. There's no sort of, it doesn't seem to be any sort of knowledge sort of spread about it or not. So when you looking at sort of the natural building side of things, the amount of knowledge that people have within it and the holistic approach, and even the people that want eco home that is actually, they are actually building it to be an eco home because it's got a low embodied energy. It doesn't need a lot of energy to run. It's not just like the eco home on Grand Designs that's got a billion tons of poured concrete inside polystyrene mm-hmm. Lego blocks.
My favorite.
So the understanding is there, but when you go to on the other side of it, it's so lacking, which is why I've been really quite excited about the courses that we've been putting on. We've had a lot of the homeowners really sort of know their stuff, but then we've had a lot of plasterers on as well that they've been doing sort of conventional damp proofing for 15, 20 years or whatever, and mm-hmm. realized that it's not working. And want to find something different. And so it is coming round, but definitely the sort of grassroots and the ground level is there. I think the issue is with like the mortgage companies and some of the sort of the, as always, the sort of bigger industry that are the slowest to do anything. Because as long as they're making money and as long as they've got a little sheet that exempts them from any wrongdoing, which is kind of what it's about. I had an architect, Anna, on one of the courses the other day, and they said that's all it's about, is they don't want to change anything, because as long as it's all signed off and they got the paper stamped, and it's just, it doesn't matter to them. It's just the easy route, which is kind of where we are, why we're using gypsum. I mean, we had all this industrial waste from coal power stations, all the gypsum build up in the chimneys that they needed to get rid of. It would cost a fortune to bury it in the ground. So let's give it to people to cover their houses in and live in.
Is that where it came from?
Yeah.
I had no idea about that.
So that's the only reason.
A waste product or a byproduct?
It's a waste product from coal power stations, and they needed some way to get rid of it, and which is generally the way. I mean, you look at our food chain. It's like some of the crap that they can't bury. It's like, well, we can either feed it to them or make them live in it, which is the only reason I can think that we're using gypsum is because they needed to get rid of it. Because it doesn't work very well. It's not, when it gets damp, it stays damp. I mean, I put some plasterboard in my ceiling. We had at the other side of the house an extension that one of the old boys that used to live here built, and he had these old, soft, really porous bricks kicking about. He just made a solid wall with cement, which just worked horrifically. It was just cold and horrible. Nothing was breathing. The bricks were working too hard to deal with this moisture. So I plastered it inside with lime to try and sort of deal with it. And then I just for cost, because it's cheap, I put gypsum plasterboard up on the ceiling, just because it's not in any contact with moisture. But just because the lime took a long time to dry because it was winter, the walls weren't breathing particularly well, because even though they were nice soft bricks, they used a hard cement to build them with. The corners of these, the gypsum just got cold and got a bit of condensation, attracted some moisture, and that was nearly five years ago, where the corners of this plasterboard got a little bit damp once before the lime was drying. And they've just got worse. The inside the room, it's bone dry. We've got heating in there, but it's just these patches just get bigger. And where the condensation cycle goes, because they've still got a little bit of moisture in them, they're a little bit colder. They're in the corner of the room. Boom, you get a bit of condensation on it, and then it evaporates, pulls more salts to the surface, attracts more condensation because of the salts. And it's just...
What's the remedy there? Is it take it out, start again?
For me, on that little corner,
yeah,
I've just got to cut that wet plasterboard out, because it's never going to dry. It's been in a warm, dry room for nigh on 4 years. It's not going to dry, so I've got to cut it out and just fire some anything else in, anything, just anything but gypsum, and it'll work. So yeah, well, I mean, it's the worst material to have in a building, where if you do have a flood or anything, or kids chuck a bucket of water up against the wall, which they like to do. And it's had it. You got it.
I think there's a danger to thinking, like, just because it's lime, it's fine. And there is that knowledge needed of the softness of, or permeability of a lime. So like if you're building, I'm thinking particularly of a project I did up in Scotland, where we were building with this really soft zone. And the guy I was working for didn't really know what he was doing, but had written heritage on the side of his van. So had got this job, and building with a really strong NHL5 mix.
Oh yeah.
And I was just like, it was not a particularly great job, I'll tell you that. But I think he was on thinking, like, just because it's lime, it's fine.
Exactly.
It's like
you need
to pair your material, like your mortar, with the building blocks.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, that's why we have to be so careful around here, because we've got such a different range of buildings and what the buildings are built out of. We've got some really hard forest sandstone that probably is a relative to, if you gauged it in strength to a hydraulic lime and your compressive strength, it's probably an NHL 20 or 30.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard. But then you've got some of these handmade soft clay bricks that can be easily 200 years old, and they're so they're basically just slight that they're fired, but some of them some of them in the kilns they would have built, some of them would have been really close to the fire, and some of them would have been packed out quite far away. So you've got a real big discrepancy of how hard these bricks are because of how hot they've been fired. So, and some of them might be probably not much stronger than an NHL 1 or 2 or a putty. It's they're really soft. So this is why we've had to look at the mixes that we've been using, and maybe using a putty or a using stone dust as a mild pozzolan with the putties and hot limes to make them still set a bit quicker if needed, but still be soft enough, or using a hydraulic lime and softening it with the ratios of sand to lime we're using, or aggregate to lime we're using, and softening it with some clay or stone dust, or because there is a huge difference, and it's really hard to know offhand, but everyone just using either a putty on one hand or a NHL 3.5 on the other, it's kind of, well, that's all you got. We've got such a huge range.
Yeah.
And when you look at what's originally there, they knew what they were doing. So if you look at what's originally there, then you can really see how hard it is, because some of the putties with stone dust that I've used have gone actually so hard when they've got a chance to carbonate. It's quite surprising. And the problem with NHLs is that each manufacturer are so different to one another in compressive strength. Even though they say they're a 3.5, to get that rating, they're sat in a lab and they probably mix it a one-to-one with a sand and dry it artificially really quickly to get to those levels of strength. A lot of the times they're a lot less than the rating, but they vary so much. It's really down to feel and getting an understanding of the material. And seeing what you've got and experienced, than just saying, right, we're going to use this because that's what we've either been told to use, or because it says lime on the packet.
Yes. I think another issue with the testing is that it's all set up for concrete testing. And so the hardness, from my understanding at least, is that it's measured at 30 days is like the final testing. And lime is carbonating for years.
Yeah, a millimetre a month.
Yeah, so you know, for 30 days, it's nothing. Yeah, you've only just... So you know, these NHL, even an NHL, you know, 2, is going to be vastly harder than they think it is.
Yeah, especially if it's mixing with a really clean sand, that's, you might have a 2-to-1 or a 2.5-to-1 aggregate sand ratio. Yeah, I mean, like you say, it feels really sad to say it, but I keep bits of lime like in the van, lumps of lime in the van, and people are just disgusted by my van generally. But yeah, I've got my lumps of lime like on the dashboard and stuff, and just testing that, and it just some of them go so hard. But then I've got bits of lime that I've taken from. I haven't chiselled it out or anything bad. I've just sort of, it's been lying around in historic sites, and I've, you know, oh yeah, I'm having that in the van to compare. And some of that's historic mortar that can be up to 900 years old is again really hard. So I mean, but that was fine. It's fine if you're using it with something that's with stone that's really hard. I mean, that's fine. It's and it's useful, because a lot of the harder stuff it might not allow moisture to come through it in drops as a solid thing, but it is completely vapor permeable. And even some of these older cements that I've seen that are maybe 80 years old that are rendered on something like around Malvern, and a lot of these old buildings with cement renders that's probably about 80 years old, with these beautiful string courses and ornate detailing, and they're not damp. there until they get painted with plastic paints a lot of the time. But even so, the plastic paint bubbles off and moisture can escape, and they still work quite well with these quite soft bricks. So they do, there is vapor movement. Mm. But yeah, there definitely, we do need to be careful with using things that are too hard. But at the same time, there's also, we need to be careful with just using, like I've spent years just using lime putties and then had similar failures and issues with that as well. So, yeah.
You've mentioned hot lime a few times there. That seems to be, certainly in the historic building world, it's like
the in thing.
It is. It's, you know, so fashionable right
which
now.
Which is the problem. It's just like, we're just using putties because that's historic, but it's not. Because those putties, the original putty was, I mean, it was cooked in a kiln, a stone-built kiln with I don't know enough about it, but maybe 50-50 with charcoal, which when burnt is a pot slan. So it's making it hydraulic. And you've probably also got all sorts of impurities going in there as well, sort of clays, and it's going to be a really dirty process. So you're not going to be getting a clean material out of that. It's going to be so many different pot slans in there. Then it's going to come to site. It's going to be mixed on site with more dirty materials that are really pozzolanic as well. So when we think we're just using putty, is like that's the historic one. That's the only thing we can use. NHLs are just cement, it's being made like pure limes are really cleanly made in gas kilns with no contaminants. It's just that is not a historic mix. Mm-hmm. It's completely different, which is why. And I love using lime putty. It's fantastic because it's like blotting paper. It just, any condensation, it can't occur. It will just be absorbed and released. It's a beautiful material, but you can't use it for everything. And because it's like a blotting paper, it just soaks stuff up. It's and now it's kind of, I don't know if because they've had some issues with putty and stuff. Now the next thing is lime putty. That's what we've got used for everything. Not lime putty, hot lime.
Yeah.
But again, I think a lot of people that are using it are trying to put sort of pozzolans in it and dirtier mixes because I think it doesn't do too well just with clean sands. Mm-hmm. But there's such a... You really need to know what you're doing, and you really need to have experimented with different mixes, different aggregates to understand what it's going to do. Because there's such a high element for changing it and getting different mixes every time. I think we need to be careful. I think it takes quite an experienced person to know how it's being affected by different things and how it should be working. So I do. I love it that it's, I mean, a proper true historical mix would be a really dirty hot lime mix full of clay, full of all sorts of stuff. But we've got this whole range of materials that we can use, but we just need the experience to understand where we're going to use them.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So you touched on your courses earlier. What's who are they mainly aimed at? Are they for homeowners or are they for builders?
Well, we've been doing crossing over and doing it for homeowners and trade all in one. And we've had a few where we've had, it's nearly been 50-50. And it's worked really well. We've had a lot of the plasterers sort of helping the homeowners with the sort of skill of plastering. And then a lot of the, the trade isn't just the plaster, it's the architects and surveyors. Mm-hmm. It's been really good. So it's been a really nice crossover because we were going to try and run them separately, but they seem to have worked really well where everyone's kind of swapping information and helping each other. And but I've really enjoyed it. I love some of the The people that have turned up that have never touched a hawk and trail before. And I've, in 2 days, we've gotten to put on a base coat, roll it up quite nicely, put a top coat on, float it, and trowel in putties and thin putty mixes to get really beautiful finishes. That it's really rewarding for me to see that. And I think everyone that's come on it has ended up doing at least a decent sized section of really nice plaster. So if they did a patch repair in their own home, mm-hmm. they could have got it perfect. So
nice.
Although it's taken me sort of 20 years because I'm self-taught. I've never, unfortunately, never worked with an old line master. Or I was listening to your podcast with Emily Reynolds. I was just like, oh, wow, if only I could have spent some time with some 70-year-old masters, that would have been amazing. But yeah. I had to kind of find my way through constant mistakes and picking up things along the way. So it's kind of something I've kind of honed over time. And then I see somebody that's never picked up a trowel before get a beautiful finish, and it's like, wow. wish I could have started there.
Lucky buggers.
Yeah, but it's nice to see that they're doing it, and everyone's so kind of into it and excited to go back and sort of and be able to sort of do some work on their own homes and understand it a bit more. It's definitely quite rewarding.
Yeah. And do you think what do you think the reason for the homeowners wanting to take this on?
A lot of people are struggling to find contractors that will do it. Either everyone's so busy that there's such long lead times. I think we're booked up for the next year. So we've just stopped doing quotes because, I mean, with lockdown, I did have a few more people that I was working with. But with lockdown, we've wanted to keep it a bit smaller. So now they're doing their own thing, and I'm just working with a labourer, and then we're outside and just minimising sort of so much contact.
Mm.
But yeah, I think it's just finding either people that are experienced enough to do it and know what they're doing, and give them sort of comfort that they know what they're talking about, or people are just so busy.
Yeah,
A lot of these jobs are just patching or doing one room, and after they come on the course, I think they're quite confident to go away and be like, right, I am going to do a whole wall, and I know that I can get it somewhere near. And I think it was I was listening to the podcast with you and Will Standwicks about, he mentioned he'd seen some of the most beautiful plastering he'd seen people do that were complete amateurs and either overworked it or it had that texture to it, and it was some real beauty. And like, yeah, why would you want it to look like perfect gypsum? Because you mm-hmm. see some of the kind of Venetian plastering these days, it's just, it does look very similar to somebody that's just like had a go and like thought, oh, well, I just keep filling it until it's nearly flat and it looks beautiful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think actually I had my dad up yesterday. And then I just haven't had enough time to give him help with some plastering. So I was like, right, come down and we'll do a little bit on my wall and stuff. So he's gone away. So he's going to give it a go. And it's just nice to see. It's
great.
Because that's what kind of building should be, much more accessible for the people that live in them. Because it always used to be, didn't it? A lot of the time people used to whack up their own buildings, farm sheds and stuff. And it is and should be that simple.
Yeah.
But it's kind of been the sort of modern building and modern materials. It's kind of, you can only touch it if you're trained.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Marvelous. That was great. I really enjoyed geeking out with Ben. So thanks very much to Ben for taking the time and to Kate for setting up the conversation. For me, I think the take-home message, other than get rid of your gypsum plaster, is that with all these variations of types of lime, clean sand, dirty sand, adding this, adding that, testing is really needed for what you have locally. So my local unwashed sand might give different results to Ben's local unwashed sand. So assume nothing. And oh yeah, so Ben and I waffled on for a bit longer about fermenting clay and lime mixes. And we also spent some time comparing and discussing some of the bagged lime products that are out there. That extra chat is available on the Building Sustainability Patreon site. That is patreon.com/buildingsustainability. To get access to that, you can name your own price and get access to that chat and loads more. In fact, there is bonus content from the Lloyd Kahn episode, Full Grown. There's a whole episode with Wibbs about breathing. There's more from Faye Blake. There's the full 4 interviews from the Earth Building trainees. There's a whole Will Statics bonus episode. More from Zukita on Earth Floors. And some more from Nick Hayes about the trespassing and right to roam. And speaking of Nick Hayes, if you sign up to the Patreon in February, I'll send you a Nick Hayes illustrated postcard to say thank you. Okay, the final thing, as promised, a few months ago I told you that I had switched my bank account to the ethical bank, Triodos. Well, I have just found out that if you use my sign-up link, which is in the show notes, you get a free £60. Not only that, but I get a £25 donation to a charity of my choice. Fantastic. And we both get to feel great about taking our money out of banks who are investing it in horrible things that we want nothing to do with. So yes, I'm not getting anything from this. I'm just keen to encourage people to store their money somewhere where it's doing some good. Okay, that is it from me. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If this is your first time, do subscribe. You can find us anywhere where you normally get podcasts. Until next time, all the best. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.